is the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, and we have a special guest today. I have Mark Weber from the Institute for Historical Review, and we're going to discuss some of the issues of the day, and as well as a very important issue, and that is Kevin MacDonald and the problems he's having in his college from the various Jewish special interest groups. Mark, how are you doing?
I'm fine, Peter. I'm glad to be on the show, and I admire your work, and I'm pleased to be here with you today.
Well, it's been quite a while since I've had you on the air.
Very, very true. And, you know, one of the things that is very encouraging to me, and you'll see this on our website to anybody who visits it or follows what we've been doing, is that with each passing month, each passing week, the news that comes out, the events as they unfold, reinforce and reconfirm over and over again the essential validity of the points we've been making over the years. And that's a very gratifying thing. Things are unfolding in accord with the way we see the world and the way that we predicted things would happen. And sometimes it's very unfortunate because the direction things are going in is not a good one. Americans know that. Public opinion polls show that and confirm that. But it's very gratifying to see events unfolding in a way that shows that our view of things is a valid and correct one.
Well, I agree with you, and I've noticed that myself. But what's not encouraging is the fact that more and more Americans seem to be unimpressed by the accuracy of your prognostications, and as well as some of the things I've predicted. They don't seem to be too interested in the accuracy of this reporting. They're more interested in the tantalizing fantasy world of these, I call them conspiracy theorists. I guess I might even fall in that category, but my conspiracy theories are based in the public record, not some fictional characterization of reptilian people or shadow people or some fictitious group led by Germanic death cult.
I'd put it this way, Peter. The country is in a way. People want solutions to the problems we're having, but they want solutions without really changing anything or sacrificing anything. America, to me, today, is a lot like a man who's in his 50s, and has had a severe problem in drinking. He's got a severe difficulties. He's overweight. He drinks too much alcohol. He eats too many double cheeseburger, and his diet is bad. But he goes to his doctor, and his doctor tells him, "You've got to change, or else you're going to die of a heart attack." And he wants to be slim and trim and healthy, but he's not willing to do anything to change his lifestyle to make that happen. That's something like the situation we're in today in America. People want things to get better without really changing any lifestyle, changing any of the ways we've been doing things. And that's the problem, I think. And that's why so many people turn to empty conspiracy views, because they think if they can just expose that, it'll all get turned around easily. And that's not going to happen.
Well, you know, Mark, with my own experience, I entered this broadcasting field as a run-of-the-mill broadcaster, just kind of a guy that wanted to report the news, have my own show, just to chit-chat with the listeners. And then I got more into it, and I progressed with the information that was available to me, and I went from being interested in these conspiracy theories to the fact that in the public record you have enough information showing the complicity of Zionism and what they're up to as far as creating their own form of a new world order, I guess you would call it. And I just could not, once I realized this was going on, I couldn't shake it. I couldn't go back to sleep. And it's amazing to me that people cling to these ideas of some supernatural force that's at work here, and they don't look at the public record. They ignore it. They'd rather believe in some mysterious force from outer space. That's That's what I've noticed. It's very, very disconcerting.
The points that we make, and I think you make as well, are easily confirmable by people who have their eyes open and are willing to look at the record. This is not any secret. We've been on this path for a long time in our country. More specifically, America has a very strange relationship with Israel, unlike any other country in the world. This relationship with Israel is a reflection of the tremendous power of the organized Jewish community in the United States. And this organized community has a role in our cultural life, in our political life, in our foreign policy that is harmful and has been increasingly harmful and will be even more harmful in the years ahead. And many Americans don't want to acknowledge that, because if that's true, it means we have a very corrupt system in place, and the responsibility then is all the greater that we do something to try to change it. But it won't be changed easily. It has to be a very, very far-reaching uprooting of the problems that we have now, because it's now so entrenched, the problem is so difficult and so bad, that unless and until we really come to grips with this major issue, there's not going to be any solution to all sorts of problems that we've been having.
Well, one of the main areas that the Jewish special interest groups like to attack is the area of free speech. This seems to be their most important area that they want to dismantle and destroy, especially in this country. And this leads me to my next question, which has to do with Kevin McDonald. Could you please give the listeners just an overview of what's happening with Kevin McDonald, Professor Kevin McDonald, and how the Jewish special interest groups are attacking him and his right of free speech?
Kevin McDonald has been for some years now a professor of psychology at California State University, Long Beach, here in Southern California. Maybe 10 years ago, he became very interested in the role of Jews in society. He's been interested in how people relate individually and as groups in society for a long time. And so his attention turned to this. The result of his work were three very detailed books, Separation and Its Discontent, A People That Shall Dwell Alone, and finally a book called The Culture of Critique. Now, these books are so solidly written and so substantial that they were issued by one of the most prestigious scholarly publishing houses in America, Prager. The series of these books issued by the publishing house was edited by a prominent Jewish specialist named Seymour Itzkoff. So there's no question about the seriousness and the solidity of his writing. But the conclusion he draws is that Jews in American society and throughout history have operated in a cohesive, organized way to promote their group interests, and that these group interests are different from and often contrary to the interests of the people among whom Jews have lived. Now, that's a startling conclusion for many people, because most Americans want to believe that American people come to this country and they assimilate and they set aside their group ethnic interests in favor of either their own individual interests or the interests of the country as a whole. And McDonald rejects that. Well, after these books came out and became more circulated or known, groups like the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith and others, which are strong which represent Jewish community interests, began attacking McDonald. And most recently, they've been demanding that the university that he teaches at and has been teaching at for years issue statements denouncing him and denouncing his writings. So this has led to a big uproar at the campus of California State University, Long Beach. This reached a high point last year when an organization called the Southern Poverty Law Center sent a person out here who published a big attack against McDonald. And then it reached another high point just a few weeks ago, about a month ago, when there was a big meeting at California State University, Long Beach, to denounce McDonald. And this meeting was organized by and had speakers from the Anti-Defamation League of Mennonite B'rith, one of the most important Jewish Zionist groups in America or in the world, the Southern Poverty Law Center, and some other special interest groups. I was at the meeting to see what they had to say. Now, one of the reasons I'm interested in this is not only that I'm interested in what McDonald has to say, and in fact, we make available and to people his book, The Culture of Critique, but also I'm interested because groups like the ADL and the Southern Poverty Law Center have attacked me and have attacked the IHR over the years. So I went to this meeting with a very special interest, not just in a general way, but also in a more in particular way. Well, what happened at the meeting really shows how these special interest groups like the ADL and so forth operate in our society. I can go into that now in more detail, but I thought you might cut me short for a minute here. But that's a basic overview of the crisis or of the controversy as it exists right now here in Southern California with Kevin McDonald.
Well, I did read in the newspaper regarding Kevin McDonald various Jewish groups that attacked him, and of course his colleagues at the university. A lot of them. I don't know what they didn't censor him, but they did have some critical words for him. And what is status now? Where does it stand today?
Well, Kevin McDonald is a tenured professor, and he can't be fired. He has some protection that way. These organizations are demanding that he be denounced, so they will, as they put it, discredit then what he has to say. But the emptiness of these claims is just obvious in the nature of the attacks against McDonald. The History Department, for example, issued a statement denouncing McDonald, claiming completely unfactually, completely untruthfully, either as a lie or just out of tremendous ignorance, in the way it characterized his writing. It shows that they either don't read or don't care what they read of what McDonald actually had to say. And McDonald's writings, again, are solid enough, important enough, that they were published again by one of America's leading academic publishers. Now, at the meeting on April 14th at Cal State Long Beach that I attended, there were speakers from the local office of the Anti-Defamation League, the Southern Poverty Law Center, a Mexican group, a homosexual group, all of them denouncing McDonald. Now, but the hypocrisy and the double standard of these people at this meeting was just obvious. And it's more and more obvious to more people just how self-serving and how hypocritical this campaign, not only against McDonald, but against anyone that Jewish groups consider harmful to their interests, really is.
All right. Well, we're going to take a very short break right now, Mark. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, with my guest, Mark Weber, of the Institute for Historical Review. Don't go away, because there is more on Shank Talk Worldwide with your host, Peter Shank. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. My guest today is Mark Weber from the Institute for Historical Review, and their website is www.ihr.org. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Got a lot of fascinating articles and books for sale, and it's just a great website, so please check it out. Right now, I'm going to get back to my guest, and we were discussing Kevin McDonald. Now, Mark, I'd like you to let the audience know, at least, you know, in the sake of fairness, what are they saying about Kevin? What are these groups, these various special interest groups, saying about Kevin McDonald's work? How are they criticizing
him? Well, at the meeting, Heidi Beirich of the Southern Poverty Law Center, the representative of the Anti-Defamation League, the representative of the Mexican organization and the homosexual organization, Lambda Legal, had nothing to say about the truthfulness or the accuracy of Kevin McDonald's scholarship. They just ignored it. They don't care if it's really accurate. They just regard it as harmful to their interests. They don't care. Now, one speaker, a fellow named Randy Blazak, who teaches at Portland State University in Oregon, where actually I went to school, he came down. And during his talk at this meeting, he denounced McDonald's writing as what he called junk science. Now, a couple of things are interesting here. First, this person making this comment has absolutely no qualifications to know whether what McDonald writes is quote, junk science or not. He has no specialty in this field whatsoever. But more than that, his denunciation of McDonald's scholarship as junk is not just an indictment or a criticism of McDonald's. It's a criticism of the Prager Publishing Company and of the people at the company who published McDonald's three very detailed and very serious works. And this is typical, though. Now, this one the character from Portland State University, he's the only one that had any comment to make about what McDonald has to say. The others were simply concerned that McDonald's writings are not helpful or harmful to Jewish Zionist interests. Now, that's one thing that was striking. And again, in a really in a fair society, McDonald's writings should be evaluated and rejected or accepted on the basis of its truthfulness and accuracy, along with every other work of scholarship. But this attempt to denounce him and have people criticize him without really regard to the accuracy of what he has to say is typical of these organizations.
Well, this is also a technique that they've used very successfully, and that is in a way to dehumanize their opponents, to marginalize their work, to just attack the work on almost like an emotional level. It has nothing to do with the facts.
What they
involved.
Do is they change the discussion from what the person has to say, and they instead make a discussion of the ethics and the character of the person making the claim. Two examples of that. Jimmy Carter, former president of the United States, issued last year a book entitled Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. And he was denounced by the usual suspects, that is, all the major Jewish Zionist organizations denounced Jimmy Carter and denounced this book, not on the basis of the accuracy of what he actually wrote, but turned the discussion into a question of whether Jimmy Carter is anti-Semitic or not. It's really irrelevant. Jimmy Carter's personal views or and what he thinks is really irrelevant to the question of whether what he actually has to say is correct or not. Now, Jimmy Carter is by no means anti-Semitic. But even if he was, that's not relevant to whether his what he has to say about Israeli policy and the U.S. relationship with Israel is true or not. And that's typical. Another example, last year, a very important book was published called The Israel Lobby in U.S. Foreign Policy. It was written by two prominent American scholars of international affairs, Stephen Walt and John Mersheimer, professors at Harvard and University of Chicago. Again, in this case as well, the major organizations like the Anti-Defamation League and so forth, these very powerful Jewish organizations, and reflected also in the media where their role is very great, denounced the book and turned it into a discussion of whether Walt Mersheimer had valid motives or not. But this is typical, again, of the kind of way that these organizations operate. Now, one of the most gratifying things about the discussion of McDonald at California State University is this. After that meeting that I was at and I mentioned earlier, an article about the meeting appeared in the student newspaper at Cal State Long Beach. And readers of the article were allowed or permitted or encouraged to write comments about the article and about the controversy discussed in the article. Amazingly, every single comment posted on the website on that article was was supportive of McDonald and critical of this campaign against him. Now, I think this shows something that is really changing in America. More and more people across the country understand and are aware of the motives behind groups like the ADL and so forth in carrying out this campaign against McDonald, Jimmy Carter, Walt Mersheimer, and the Institute for Historical Review.
Well, you know what worries me the most, Mark, is the fact that we might be waking up to the danger of these groups that you referred to, but what people don't seem to get is the danger of the enemy within. And what I mean by that, there are groups that pose as run-of-the-mill American conservative groups like the neocons, but they are completely infiltrated by the pro-Israel lobby. They are completely infiltrated by Jews, and yet people don't get it. They think they belong to the good old, the grand old party and the conservative right, and it's not the case.
You've hit on something very important. It goes to really the nature of our society, the nature of our social political system. There are millions of Americans out there. They're good people for the most part, and they want to believe in America. This is a country where the flag is still the same flag we've had before. We still have supposedly in place the same constitution. We still use the same currency. And so people think or like to think that this is still the America of 50 or 80 or 100 years ago. It's not. There's been a kind of revolution, a kind of takeover of our country and of its institutions, so that even though the flag is still in place, the essential nature and character of America has changed fundamentally, and millions of Americans are deceived by that. They vote for a man like George W. Bush, or they support leaders who have shown by their actions that they put their own individual interests or the interests of pressure groups ahead of the interests of the American people. And this is a very, very sad situation. It's a terrible situation. The problem is that our system is now essentially a corrupt one. Our political leaders, on the biggest issues that matter to the future of our country and the world, simply don't care what the interests of America are and what the American people think. The two biggest issues that I think objectively are critical to the future of America are the issues of war and immigration. Public opinion polls show overwhelmingly Americans want some way out of the mess of the war in Iraq, and they want some grip, some control of this problem of illegal immigration. But our political leaders simply disregard, throw aside the will of the people on these two critical issues and push ahead because they don't really care. They want to get reelected, and they will obey not the American people, but the money interests and the media and so forth, which makes it possible for them to get reelected. And that's a very big problem. But most Americans don't want yet to grasp or accept the fact of just how bad the situation really is in our country.
Well, you know, Mark, one of the things that fascinates me is coming from the Patriot Radio. You know, I used to be on Republic Broadcasting, and it was a Patriot radio station. And these individuals that call themselves patriots claim to be fighting the New World Order. But I can't understand how a group of people can fight the New World Order but cling to the idea of multiracialism, or cling to the idea of multiculturalism, as many of these patriots and libertarians do. Doesn't make any sense.
Well, I would say this. Many of these people who call themselves patriots, their idea of America is a country where everybody thinks about himself as an individual. They have this idea that if everybody just does what's in his own personal interest, that will be the best interest of the country. Well, it's silly. It's childish, really. It's silly. Those people focus a lot on rights. Now, rights are important. Our civil rights are important, of course. If we didn't have some rights, we wouldn't be able to have a radio show or a broadcast like this one. But a society and a people and a nation's future is not dependent on its rights. It's dependent on holding together the foundation of that nation and that people. And that's being destroyed in our country. A country is more, a nation is more than just the sum of all the individuals that make it up. And that's one of the problems of many of these people. Their idea of America, they're not really loyal to America at all, because their idea of America is a country where they individually are going to do well. They don't really care about whether about a nation where they may have to make sacrifices for the future for their children or grandchildren. They're primarily focused on their own individual happiness and welfare.
And you also see this trend with the popularity of, let's say, inheritance. It's very popular nowadays for the, let's say, the head of the household who passes away and he leaves all of his fortune to charity, not to his children, not to his family. This falls in line with what you're saying, because the way you take care of your family, one of the ways, is to leave them some kind of inheritance that they can build upon and start their own lives. And you see this in the movies. You see this in real life. This is a very popular idea. Everybody wants to be the next Andrew Carnegie and leave their inheritance to charity, so they'll have a big statue built of themselves in the public square. This seems to be a trend, but it was manufactured out of whole cloth by the Jewish media. This is something that came out of the 1940s movies that the Jews were putting out at the time.
Well, I would just stress this. People in our society do what is going to be popular. So a Bill Gates will put huge amounts of money to try to deal with diseases and so forth in Africa. Well, however laudable that may be, however admirable that may be, in the long run, it means he doesn't really care much about his own country, his own people, his own nation, and so forth. But it's popular to do that. It's politically correct to do what he's doing. And so people go along with the prevailing worldview of our society. And that's changed a great deal over the years in America. Very few Americans, and this is why a sense of history is important, to understand that the views that we hold in America today, or that are popular, or that are politically correct today, are not the same views that people had 50 years ago, or 80 years ago, or 100 years ago, and in another 50 years, or 80 years, they will have different views. But there's a very, very widespread view in this country, even among so-called conservatives, that whatever the prevailing view is, that's the way it should be, that's the way it ought to be, and they're mindless, they just don't care or think about how things have changed over the years.
I think it's amazing if you, it's really amazing to look at the effectiveness of the media and the way the Jews have used the media to get their agenda across. I was watching a motion picture the other night. It was from the 1930s or 40s. And it was a Western, and at the end of the story, we find out that the Indians who were attacking the settlers were not really Indians. They were white men disguised as Indians. And at the very end, the real Indians show up and save the settlers from the white guys who are masquerading as Indians. This type of theme was being promoted back in the 40s.
Right. Well, a couple of things. First of all, we have this astonishing phenomenon in America that our nation, which makes it illegal practically, or certainly it's forbidden, to uphold any cultural, racial, religious, ethnic cohesiveness in this country. It's wrong to promote that for the United States of America. But the same country, the same politicians who say it's wrong in our country, support a foreign country, Israel, that's based on precisely those things. Our political leaders say Israel must maintain its specifically Jewish, ethno-religious character. But in this country and in other countries, we're told that diversity is a strength, and that a country should not have any specific racial, ethnic, cultural, or religious character. Another point about the schizophrenia in our country in that way is that people show by the way they live their lives that they don't really believe the slogans that we all claim to accept. We're told that diversity is a strength. We're told that the massive immigration from third world countries to the United States is a good thing. But Americans show by where they live, where they want to go, where they want to send their children to school, that they don't really believe those slogans. And the schizophrenia, the contrast between the way people live their lives in their own, actually how they live their lives, on the one hand, and the politically correct slogans that we mouth and embrace on the others, is more and more obvious with each passing year.
All right, well, we're going to take a very short break and be right back with my guest, Mark Weber, from the Institute for Historical Review. This is Shank Talk Worldwide. I'm your host, Peter Shank. And we are broadcasting across the airwaves courtesy of the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Don't go away, there's more. This is Shank Talk Worldwide. My guest today is Mark Weber from the Institute for Historical Review. Very quickly, their website is www.ihr.org. It's a fantastic website. Please check it out when you get a chance. Now, Mark, I want to read to you very quickly what I think is a great introduction for you. And so I'm going to read it to you very quickly. More than any other propagandist, Mark Weber embodies the Holocaust denial movement, an articulate, media-savvy spokesperson with a master's degree in history from Indiana University. Weber got his start in the radical right in 1978 when he took the position of news editor for National Vanguard, a publication of the neo-Nazi National Alliance. In 1979, Weber also began to contribute regularly to The Spotlight, a weekly tabloid produced by Willis Carto's Liberty Lobby organization. I just wanted to say that's a great, great introduction, and that was courtesy of the ADL.
Well, thank you. Yeah, the ADL, of course, is trying to present me in a way as unfavorable as possible. But yeah, if the ADL was not attacking me, if the ADL was just neutral about me, I don't think I'd be doing my job. If an American really cares about our country, the future, and the world, and humanity, they should be on the ADL blacklist. They should be on the ADL, should be attacked by the ADL. That's why the ADL attacks people as diverse as Jimmy Carter, as Walton Mearsheimer, I mentioned earlier, Kevin McDonald, because they regard these people as harmful to their collective interests. And it's inevitable, because the ADL pushes an agenda that is contrary to, different from, harmful to, the interests of America and the interests of the world. But they don't care. They're pushing their specific agenda. By the way, the ADL blurb goes on to make statements that are just factually untrue, but they don't care about that either. That doesn't matter to them. But again, I'm proud to be in the radar, the firing line of the Anti-Defamation League and the Simon Wiesenthal Center and so forth, because if we weren't being attacked by these organizations, we wouldn't be doing our job.
Well, let's talk about a fellow who is really caught in the crossfire of these groups, and that was Mr. David Irving. And you have a meeting coming up on June 14th, and I know the information is on your website, so anyone interested in this meeting on June 14th, please go to the IHR website. But David Irving has had a lot of problems, and he's one of my, I really respect David Irving. I've enjoyed his books, and please tell us a little bit about David Irving and what's going on with him today.
Well, David Irving, up until the late 1970s, was one of the most successful historians in the world. He's the author of something like 30, 40 books, many of them bestsellers. His books, up until the late 70s, were published by the leading and major publishing houses in the United States, Britain, and other countries. But he came afoul or ran up against groups like the ADL in the 1970s with his book entitled Hitler's War. And he's gotten into more trouble since then by making remarks that are politically incorrect or contrary to the prevailing view about what history ought to be. Now, he got his name was in headlines all over the world in 2005 when he was visiting Austria. He was arrested by the police in November of 2005, put on trial in a trial that received a tremendous amount of publicity, and sentenced to several years in prison for remarks he had made 16 years earlier in Austria. He had made a reference in a talk to mythical gas chambers at Auschwitz I main camp. Now, I can go into the factuality of what he had to say, but for having simply made a remark to a closed meeting 16 years earlier, he was sentenced to prison. He was let out early. He served 13 months in prison in Austria for remarks like this. Now, this is typical of the United States and of these organizations like the ADL, that they did nothing to denounce this outrage against freedom of speech and freedom of expression and freedom of conscience. They think such laws like that are just fine. In several European countries, it's a crime to view that are counter or different that, than the official view. And David Irving ran afoul of this law. Now, he's now in the United States on his first visit here since his arrest and imprisonment in Austria, and he'll be speaking here in Southern California on June 14th, a Saturday evening. People who are interested can contact us, and we'll get them information about the meeting. But David Irving is going to talk about his amazing ordeal and the imprisonment and so forth at this meeting, as well as he's going to talk again about some myths about World War II, which is his specialty.
Now, I remember David Irving, he wrote a book entitled Hitler's War, and that was my introduction into David Irving. I read the book, and it was a fantastic read. I couldn't put it down, but it turns out David Irving was the first historian to even research the German documents regarding World War II.
Well, I wouldn't say he's the first, but Irving is noted. Even people who don't like Irving acknowledge that he is outstanding in his pursuit and investigation of original documents and resource materials, interviews with people, and so forth. Irving, he has no peer in that way. And even people who dislike what he has to say or his conclusions acknowledge that he's an outstanding historian in that way. But yeah, Hitler's War is a tremendously important book because it is based so much on original archival research and on interviews with people who were first person witnesses to the events that he's writing about.
In addition to that, David Irving was such an esteemed expert that the British government used him to identify the Hitler diaries. He was called into ascertain whether they were fake or legit. Do you recall
that? Well, there's two things here. No, I mean, the British government didn't call him in. David Irving denounced the so-called Hitler diaries that were a big scandal 20 years ago as fake. He did this on his own, but he was also hired by one of the leading newspapers in Britain to evaluate and make public the so-called Goebbels diaries. That is real. Goebbels kept that was Hitler's propaganda minister, his kind of press spokesman. He kept a very, very extensive diary. Those were seized after the war by the Soviets and held for years in Russian archives. And David Irving was hired by, I think, the Telegraph or the Times, one of the major newspapers in Britain, to evaluate and make public these important diaries. But Irving was widely considered a great and important investigator, researcher, and historian. But now, of course, he's, as they say, discredited because of some dissident views he's expressed about aspects of World War II history.
You know, I can't think of any historical event other than the Holocaust where they actually make laws prohibiting investigation of the event and coming
right.
up with
well,
a contrary
this is a very,
position.
Very important. Right, this is a very important feature of all of this. The only chapter of history that in these countries it's illegal to question is the Holocaust or the Second World War. You can question or present dissident views about all sorts of other events since and before the Second World War, but this is a taboo in Europe because the Second World War is kind of the central mythos, the central good versus evil story of the 20th century, including here in the United States. We just had a meeting last Saturday here in California, IHR meeting, and I spoke in great detail about the national mythology in our country of World War II and the U.S. role in World War II. And I did my best to dismantle and look into that mythology and why I think that myth of U.S. role in World War II is a dangerous one for our country and for the world. But yeah, World War II, because it was such a cataclysmic event that changed so much in the world and secured America's place in the years afterwards as the number one military, financial, and economic power in the world, is still a very, very important narrative or historical chapter, and it's upheld officially and semi-officially here in our country.
And you know, the famous spin doctor, Edward Bernays, his brother-in-law, Murray Bernays, was the one of the lead prosecutors at the Nuremberg trials. And this led me to believe that somehow Edward Bernays and his brother-in-law somehow stage-managed the information coming out of there from the Soviets, all the information that was being used to prove there were these concentration camps. It was all given to us by the Soviets. But Edward Bernays and his brother-in-law, I believe, were stage-managing the event. What is your opinion on that?
Well, there's a very detailed article by me posted on our website entitled The Nuremberg Trials and the Holocaust, I think. Anyway, it's a very big, major article I've written about the Nuremberg Trials, in which I point out that any number of very prominent Jewish organizations took credit for playing this very prominent role in the Nuremberg Trials. Specifically, the World Jewish Congress, one of the most important and powerful Jewish Zionist organizations in the world, claimed and laid out in some detail how their people had played this big role in putting the German leaders on trial. Now, the important thing, I think, is that justice applied selectively is not justice. It's a form of injustice. And the German leaders were put on trial, and some of them put to death, for actions that the Allies, the very people carrying out the trials, were guilty of. And this is just blatant injustice. If people are executed on the basis of a law that applies only to one group and not to another group. But very few Americans know about this or understand any of this. We now know much more accurately than we did in 1945 how much of the testimony and the evidence, so-called, presented at Nuremberg was fake and wrong, doctored up, and so forth. But this is the Nuremberg trials and the Second World War is still a part of the kind of, you might say, the American national mythology, and it's still very dangerous and difficult to dismantle or to look at that period of history objectively.
Well, now the big push is to build these gay Holocaust memorials around the world. That's the new thing. I don't know if you're aware of that at all.
Well, yeah. Every group, I mean, one of the problems in our society is a kind of a victimization complex. If you can show that the group you are a member of, whether it's Jews or blacks or gays, was persecuted at some point in the past, that's supposed to give you a kind of a ticket of you're supposed to support such groups because they've been victimized or persecuted in the past. The thinking behind this whole way of this whole thing is crazy. It's stupid. Just because a group has been victimized doesn't make that group or people in that group any smarter or better or morally superior. But that's the implication in our society. And it's just one example, I think, of the kind of screwed up way that we're supposed to look at history. Not in terms of what happened, but in terms of who are the good guys or who are the bad guys according to the politically correct standards of our age.
Well, I've got to ask you this because I'm just curious. I noticed David Irving made some comments about 9-1-1. What are your feelings on the 9-1-1 terror attacks? Who do you think was behind it?
Behind it.
And for what reason?
No, I don't know what Irving said. My own view is that I'm skeptical of the skeptics. That is, I was at a conference put on by David Irving, and one of the speakers at that conference was a major player, an important person in the what they call the 9/11 truth movement, and he presented a video and so forth. But I was very skeptical of his evidence for a lot of reasons. I try to keep an open mind about the issue, but I'm not very persuaded by those people who say that 9/11 was an inside job. They don't seem to me to be presenting evidence that I think is very compelling. But what I'm more worried about is this. I'm more concerned that many of the people who focus on 9/11, these 9/11 skeptics, seem unconcerned about the whole Middle East. They seem focused entirely on what the Bush administration or people inside are doing and seem to ignore completely the fact that as a result of U.S. Middle Eastern policy and the U.S. alliance with Israel and U.S. support for Israeli policies, there are, in fact, millions of people in Arab and Muslim countries and around the world who hate and detest the United States and its government so much that they're willing to kill and die to make clear just how strongly they oppose American policy.
It seems like people in this country don't understand or comprehend the idea of a true believer. They always say, follow the money, follow the money. I don't buy that. I believe that there are people in the world known as true believers that will strap on a bomb, jump on an airplane, and blow themselves up. I mean, we see it all the time. But they don't want to factor that into the equation. I think that's a very big mistake.
Well, as I say, I'm just repeating myself, but many of these people who are so concerned about 9/11 just don't seem to understand or even care about America's place in the world and its foreign policy. Look, you know, many people really do hate what our government is doing, and what the United States government is doing in its support of Israel and the policies is outrageous. It makes a mockery of the principles we claim to uphold. It's harmful to our interests. It's inhumane, cruel. It's terrible. We support wars and oppression in this way. But many of these 9/11 truth people don't seem to care about that. They're just interested in trying to find how George Bush has masterminded this thing from the inside. If it were only that simple. The problem is that this U.S. policy in the Middle East and around the world is supported over by our mass media, by our politicians of both major parties, and it's not going to change if George Bush goes out of office or not.
All right, before we conclude the interview, I have one last question here. We've got some elections coming up. Quickly, what is your prediction, and how do you think the new president will be, how do you think he'll treat the Middle East situation?
Well, both parties and both political, both of the leading candidates, Barack Obama and McCain, have made very clear that they are ardent supporters, strong, staunch supporters of the U.S. alliance with Israel, and that they support Israel's policies, even when those policies are unjust, inhumane, and contrary to what's good for America. And now, having said that, Barack Obama does not seem as out of the loop and just crazy about policy as John McCain. I'm not supposed to endorse candidates, and I don't, but I think that marginally, U.S. foreign policy is likely to be a little more balanced with Barack Obama than with John McCain. But we don't know. And one of the problems in America is that our leaders have had such a record of being unprincipled, of not doing what they say, that we don't know what they'll do until they actually get into office. Remember, George W. Bush campaigned promising, or implying anyway, that he was going to have a less adventurous, a less reckless foreign policy, but he did very, very differently than he had given the impression. Of course, his policies have been anything but conservative, but his base of support and the reason so many people elected him was because he was a so-called conservative, even though his policies turned out to be very, very different than what he had said.
All right, I appreciate your time, Mark, and I'd like you to tell the audience one more time about your meeting on June 14th. Let them know how to get tickets or how to get where it's located.
Well, contact us. Check out the website. On the homepage of our website is a notice about the June 14th meeting. Our telephone number and our email address are easy to get. I invite people, even if they aren't able to attend the meeting, to check out the website. There's a lot there, a lot happening, and I hope people who live in the Southern California area especially will attend the meeting on June 14th.
We're also hoping that somebody from VOR will get down there and maybe broadcast live from the meeting. So we'll see what happens.
Okay.
I want to thank you once again. It's a really great pleasure to have you on again, and I wish you a lot of luck.